It is a great pleasure to welcome to Wide Moat Investing Summit 2023, Alex Furmansky, partner and investor at Unison Asset Management. Alex has more than two decades of professional investing experience. Prior to Unison, from 2011 to 2017, Alex was managing partner and founder at Safe Harbor Investment Partners, private investment partnership focused on investments in public equities, employing the same approach being used at Unison Asset Management. From 2005 to 11, Alex was senior associate at Kronos, a private investment partnership based in New York. And from 2003 to 2005, he was an investment banking analyst in the global healthcare group at Merrill Lynch. Alex was born and raised in Bogota, Colombia. He earned a Bachelor of Science in Economics, cum laude, with a concentration in finance from the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School in 2003. Such a great pleasure to have you with us in this forum, Alex. I very much look forward to your presentation and would now like to turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Great. Well, thank you, John. Thank you for hosting me. Just, you know, by way of quick background, I joined the MOI community, I think over 10 years ago, but I had not really engaged actively until recently. I've attended several of your in-person events and found the quality of the people to be great. So hopefully the idea I'm presenting today adds to the discourse in the community. And I very much look forward to continued engagement. Just by way of quick agenda for today, I'll just do two or three quick intro slides on Unison to frame our thinking and then just go from there into our idea. So Unison, we're a long-only concentrated public equities partnership. Our portfolio is typically made up of 20 to 25 positions. With a U.S. bias, really spanning across market caps and sectors. Unison was founded in 2017. We're based in Miami, and we currently have $175 million in AUM. Just quickly, in terms of our approach at Unison, it's pretty straightforward. We use a private owner mental model to find great businesses with durable competitive advantages. And what we really look to do is buy these companies at attractive prices, so with a sufficient discount or margin of safety to their intrinsic value, and then hold them as long as they stay great, which can really range from several years to ideally never sell. And really, throughout our process, there's two main questions we're looking to answer. The first is, how good is this business or the business in question, which can really range from poor to average to good to great. That's largely a qualitative exercise. And then number two, how much is the business worth? We determine that ultimately by building a DCF. That's a largely quantitative exercise. But as we all know, you know, an Excel spreadsheet can tell you whatever you want to know. And really, the output is only as good as the variables that you're putting into it. So this is where we spend the majority of our time during our research process. And to answer these two questions, we really go through the four pillars that are up on this slide. Number one is product. A question we'd love to ask ourselves is, if the product or service of the company that we're looking at were to disappear tomorrow, would anyone miss it? We try to quantify the unit economics of the product, define the customer value proposition for customers. And our goal is really to hone in on the key value drivers and get a sense of how these might change going forward. In terms of people, alignment is critical. Ideally, you know, the companies where we invest have a large ownership from insiders. We look for good capital allocators. And here we pay a lot of attention to their historical track record. Are they buying back shares, you know, constantly to avoid, you know, dilution from stock options? Is it, you know, kind of more opportunistic based on the stock price, et cetera? Then, you know, the third pillar is the balance sheet. Here, the emphasis is really making sure that, you know, the business has a thoughtful capital structure that can withstand, you know, very hard times. And lastly, and aptly for the summit, is the moat. You know, we've developed a framework largely inspired by the work of Michael Porter, who's the patron saint of competitive analysis, if you will. We like to call it our CAF, our competitive advantage framework. And it, you know, forces us to grade the intensity of the competitive forces within an industry, and to the extent possible, qualify the source and durability of a business's competitive advantage. And the output of the process that I just described is really, you know, what we like to call our tier list, which is what we believe are the best businesses to own in public market, in public markets across the world. That list is has a little bit south of 100 names on it. And many times what we do is, you know, we observe them and wait for Mr. Market to present a price to us that that makes sense. In terms of what makes Unison different, there's three key things to highlight. The first is alignment. The owners of Unison are the largest investors in our funds. We have the preponderance of our liquid net worth invested in our funds. We also have, you know, family, friends, close people invested as well. And, you know, we really eat our own cooking. Number two, we've actively sought out a like-minded capital base that really allows us to invest patiently and prudently for the long term. This is a critical point. And for example, last year, which was a very difficult year in the markets, we came out fairly well. And the reason is, you know, we avoided paying high prices for many of the businesses on our watch list because, you know, we have the patient capital to wait. And lastly, and somewhat tied to this, is our unique style. We saw in one presentation recently from a peer that, you know, we're definitely in the minority. And how do we define that? You know, they came up with a study where they quantified that only 1% of money in global equities is invested using a concentrated value investing approach like ours. And that's defined as one position greater than 5% and annual turnover less than 30%. If you look at our portfolio today, probably about a third of the names have been with us since we started managing capital on our own in 2011. And the turnover of our portfolio is south of 15%. And, you know, tying this a little back to this summit, you know, the only way you can really invest for the long term is by emphasizing moats. So with that prelude, let's jump straight into the idea that we're presenting today, which is CDW Corp. So starting on this slide, on the left, this is the cover of Forbes magazine in November 1998. The title, Artificial Intelligence Gets Real. And the company that was profiled in this issue is a company called PCOrder.com. Which I guess, unless you were active in the markets back then, you probably don't recognize because the company no longer exists. We're here today to talk not about high tech, as you know, defined on the left-hand side of this slide as artificial intelligence. We're here to talk about low tech. The AI chat is probably in a different session at this summit. The key message is that boring can often be better in investing. And that, you know, hypes and narratives often get blown out of proportion. Just, you know, on this chart at the top is CDW's stock price. This is from the time of its second IPO in 2013 through now. The company, you know, has done fairly well. It's gone up 833%, which is a CAGR of 25%. We've been fortunate enough to own it since the pre-Unison days. Buying our first shares in 2014. And in the bottom is what I just alluded to, you know, PC Order, whose stock peaked at around $80 per share in 99, and then subsequently went essentially to zero. So what does CDW do? They're the largest value-added reseller of IT products to small and medium-sized businesses in the US, Canada, and the UK. What does that mean? Essentially, they help tech companies of all sizes sell to small and medium-sized businesses, as well as smaller government clients. Their vendor partners range from mega tech incumbents like Microsoft and Cisco, to new challengers such as Splunk and Five9. They sell over 100,000 products from over 1,000 partners. And their reason for existence is, you know, it's a very fragmented customer base that they're serving, which would be very impractical for IT vendors to reach with their own sales force, which they usually focus on the larger fish. Tying CDW and what they do to what I alluded to before would, you know, suppliers care if CDW vanished from the face of the earth tomorrow? And I think the answer is unequivocally yes. You know, the top five vendor partners do over $1 billion in sales through CDW, and the next 15 vendor partners do over $100 million in sales. So, you know, CDW is a very important partner for a lot of these tech companies. On this slide, you can get a sense of the logos that CDW works with. It's really a who's who in the tech world. Pretty much every tech company you can think of works with CDW, including many of the AI providers that are in the news lately. Some key facts about CDW. The company is headquartered in right outside of Chicago. $24 billion in net sales in 2022. Over 250,000 different customers, 15,000 employees, number 166 on the Fortune 500 ranking. And like I said, primarily a US business, but in more recent years also expanded, mainly because the customers were requesting it, into the UK and Canada. One of the things we try to do when we're looking at a prospective investment is really understand the company's history to understand its DNA. In these next two slides, I'm just going to cover some of the key milestones on CDW's journey, along with some sales numbers and the number of workers, just so you get a sense of the progression. I think this is particularly helpful for people outside of the US who probably might not even have heard of this name before. So the company was founded in 1984. It first IPO'd in 1993. At the time, it had a little bit south of $300 million in sales and 250 workers. By the time it switched from being a catalog-only provider to selling online, this was 95, it had already reached over $600 million in sales. By 1997, it had surpassed $1 billion in sales with roughly 1,000 coworkers. By the time it made it onto the Fortune 500 company at number 435 in 2001, it had almost $4 billion in sales. And then in 2007, the company was LBO'd by Madison Dearborn, $8 billion in sales and over 6,000 workers. In 2013, it went public for the second time. By that point, it had $11 billion in sales and 7,000 co-workers. And all the way till today, where, you know, the company is doing around $24 billion in sales, over 15,000 employees. And very interestingly, you can see the CAGRs here. You know, this is a company that has compounded its top line at 29% since inception, as well as its coworker count. So quite a journey and quite a history. What is CDW's value proposition? You know, they're far more than a hardware seller. They play, you know, a critical role in designing, deploying, and providing aftermarket support of the IT infrastructure they help their partners with. They're an agnostic partner. So when a customer comes to CDW with a problem in search of a solution, you know, CDW does all the technical work. They do the comparison about pricing and what might be the best solution for the customer's need. And, you know, be it on-prem, hybrid, fully on the cloud. And they're really incentivized to work within the parameters that the customer gives them because, you know, they're agnostic as to the vendor since they work with pretty much all of the tech ecosystem. They can really focus on what's best for the customer. And from the customer's point of view, you know, it makes them more efficient. It's really impractical for a customer to vet and negotiate with, you know, dozens of different IT vendors. And, you know, it allows them to focus on their core efforts. These are some numbers in terms of, well, sales we alluded to. These are numbers since the company went public in 2013. Through, you know, the first quarter of this year. So you can see, you know, the very nice progression in terms of top line on the gross profit line. You see that the CAGR is 2 points above net sales. And, you know, that translates into a little bit of operating leverage at the EBIT level and, you know, with share repurchases, this is net income, but anyway, they've been active in share repurchases, but you know, even more progression here. The net income differential CAGR is mainly due to, you know, the company was an LBO, and as they paid down debt, you know, that accrued and gave it more of a kicker down here. But you know, what's interesting about this slide and something I'd like to highlight is that the one constant in business is change. CDW has evolved from a pure hardware catalog seller to also selling software and services, which actually has been accretive to margins. So, you know, when the netted down revenues include these categories, which are now almost a third of sales, you can see, you know, the inflection in their margins down here from, you know, historically the mid sevens to now closer to nine, actually. Oh, and sorry, one other point before the next slide is the CAGR in the stock price definitely has benefited a little bit from multiple expansion, but as you can see, it's mainly been driven by earnings growth, which is, you know, what we'd ideally love to see as investors. In terms of the customer breakdown, more than 50% of sales comes from corporate and small businesses. Really, the sweet spot for CDW is businesses with less than 5,000 employees. But you can see that, you know, it's fairly well diversified. You also have government, education, and healthcare, which tend to be much less cyclical, making up an important part of the revenue stream. And this is important because, you know, obviously IT spending is cyclical. And when you hit, you know, a bump in the road, like in 2008, you know, the corporate segment, you know, goes down. I think it was down more than 20%. But at the same time, in 08 and 09, the government and education business grew. So it's important to have, you know, a diverse set of customers for the stability of earnings. So now the fun part and talking about the moat. I'm going to read this quote from Buffett, which I'm sure several of you have heard, but maybe some of you have not. The key to investing is not assessing how much an industry is going to affect society or how much it will grow, but rather determining the competitive advantage of any given company and above all, the durability of that advantage. I think, you know, I often find commentators in public markets miss this. And, you know, it seems to be a continual search for, you know, growth, mainly top line growth. In at least the short-term momentum of stock prices. But you know, this quote is very powerful. And actually tying this back to something else that Buffett said, I think in a speech, I believe it was in 2001, he made a very interesting point that, you know, if you knew at the turn of the 20th century that horse carriages were gonna go, were eventually gonna be displaced by cars, you're not necessarily going to make any money investing in the leading car makers of the time. You know, at the time, there were three auto companies in the Dow Industrials. This is the 1920s and 30s, Studebaker, Nash, Kelvinator, and Hudson Motors. None of these companies exist anymore. So, you know, figuring out the economic characteristics of the winners in a growing business is not necessarily easy. I think that point is lost on a lot of observers and commentators and investors. So what's the source of CDW's moat that has allowed it to deliver, you know, the spectacular numbers that I just went through? Really, you know, it comes down to scale. And we at Unison consider scale to be one of the strongest sources of moat. So, you know, particularly as it relates to CDW, they're three times the size of their next largest competitor. This allows them to get favorable pricing from their vendor partners and allows them to have an EBIT margin more than twice that of peers. There's a typo here. This is 7.5. It's 8.5. You know, and so while CDW thrives, a lot of their competitors struggle to beat the cost of capital at margins, you know, closer to 3%. Point number two related to scale is their 6,400 technical coworkers that can be brought to bear on any project a client might have. And as the IT solutions world becomes more complex, the need for these capability increases, and so does the moat around CDW. You know, smaller competitors don't really have, you know, the same resources to bring to bear to a customer as CDW. And somewhat tied to this is talent. You know, here we're looking at the revenue per employee of CDW versus its two closest public competitors, Insight and PC Connection. And you can see that, you know, the productivity of CDW's employees is significantly higher. And, you know, this really becomes a virtuous circle where, you know, the best and brightest talent in the industry wants to work at CDW because, you know, they can make more money there. How does the moat translate into returns? This is a slide from CDW basically showing the return on working capital. CDW, as you might surmise, has very negligible tangible capital. Its capital is really its people. It's less than, you know, the CapEx spend as a percent of sales is less than 1%. And so, you know, these are pretty impressive numbers. We tend to focus a little more on return on incremental invested capital. That metric, you know, for us on CDW is kind of in the closer to the mid-20s range, which is still very attractive. What's the opportunity from here for CDW? You know, on the left-hand side, we have the addressable market. So the total tech stack spend in the US, the UK, and Canada, the markets where CDW operates, is $1.4 trillion. CDW doesn't obviously address all of this, but it's, you know, they do address roughly $500 billion of spend. And as I alluded to, you know, they're at $24 billion. So, you know, they basically have around 5% of their total addressable market. And what's very interesting is here on the right-hand side, you can see that, you know, from 2006 through 22, they've outgrown US IT spend by over 200 basis points per year. And that accelerated after the 2009 crisis, and then, you know, with a company growing over 300 basis points a year higher than the underlying market. So, you know, there is a long runway for CDW to continue to grow and thrive. Here we take a look at valuation. So the company today we think is trading at a pretty reasonable value. It's trading at 18 times consensus earnings estimates for 23. And what we did in this slide is to try to address, you know, how we think about the margin of safety on this investment. And basically on the left-hand side, you see what would happen, you know, at what penetration level of IT spend by increments of 100 basis points, what that does, you know, to the valuation, both on a PE and EV to EBIT basis. So you can see that, you know, the company gains 100 basis points of market share, the effective multiple that you're paying is not, you know, 18 times, but rather 15, and an EV to EBIT of 12, and so on. So, you know, if you believe that CDW will continue to gain share for a lot of the reasons that I mentioned, we obviously do, the true multiple becomes a lot more palpable than the headline multiple. Another key point, which I alluded to earlier in talking about Unison's philosophy, is alignment. You know, in this case, management has, you know, significant skin in the game. They own shares worth roughly $55 million. Interestingly, the CEO has bought around $2 million at current levels, most, and including a recent buy in the last month. And, you know, one thing we'd like to do when we're looking at a new situation is look at the proxy statement and really understand how management teams are being compensated. You know, all human beings react to incentives. And if boards are measuring the wrong metrics, you might end up with results you don't like as a shareholder. And in CDW's case, you know, it's a nice example of how, you know, management comp is structured to incentivize and align, you know, the management team with us as minority shareholders. So I've given you a lot of the reasons why you should buy CDW. Now let's, you know, balance it with what are some of the risks. The first risk, which you'll probably read about if you do a little bit more research, at least perceived risk, is, you know, the transition to the cloud. You know, the fear is that as more spend moves to the cloud, there's less money to spend on, you know, on-prem servers and things like that. What's interesting is that if you know, the cost of running a whole IT tech structure on the cloud is not trivial. And some believe that the total addressable market of these cloud companies is somewhat overhyped. For instance, in 2017, when Dropbox went public in its S1, they alluded to $75 million in cumulative savings over 2 years prior to the IPO by optimizing their infrastructure, their IT infrastructure, and really repatriating workloads from the public cloud into their own cloud. So that's just one example, but if you know, look online, you'll see many other examples of the same thing, where, you know, a company starts working with the cloud and then all of a sudden they start seeing the size of the bills and, you know, they decide some of the workloads are better in the cloud, some are better on-prem. And so, you know, obviously the large cloud providers would lead us to believe, you know, that the TAM might be a lot bigger than it actually is. And there's other considerations, you know, stuff like regulation, security, control of the data also play an important role. And so we believe that, you know, the transition to the cloud is not a zero-sum game. There's definitely going to be an important part of workloads that, you know, is done in a hybrid type environment. And even if you believe that, you know, everything will migrate to the cloud ultimately, companies will still need, you know, help integrating different cloud environments with different middleware, et cetera, as most won't, you know, put all their eggs in one basket. And so that would still, you know, give CDW and other VARs a pretty important role to play. So that's, you know, risk number one. Risk number two, and this is really more of a near-term risk to earnings than anything else, is, you know, the company, like many others, are cyclical. And in a slowdown like the one we're seeing now in the U.S. economy and tech spend, especially, you know, after the COVID madness, it impacts, you know, CDW. So I think in the last month, CDW said that it came out with a profit warning, if you will, saying that it expects the U.S. IT market to decline high single digits for 2023. It still expects to outgrow, you know, the IT market by 200 to 300 basis points. But nonetheless, you know, that's a revision from its original guidance at the beginning of the year. So, you know, that in and of itself, you know, kind of a short-term earnings risk. It's somewhat discounted already in the stock price. What's nice about CDW is since it's very capital light, it has a very flexible cost structure. A big part of their cost is sales commissions to their coworkers. And obviously, as you know, sales volume activity declines, so does this lever. And so, for instance, during the GFC, revenue went down 11%, and EBIT was down, you know, 30%. But this isn't a company that's going to lose money at the bad part of the tech cycle, like, you know, a lot of other tech companies might. Third risk is leverage. We believe, you know, it's manageable. It's 2.5 times levered. But given, you know, the variable cost structure that I just described, even, you know, in a bad environment, the company still has ample EBIT coverage on its balance sheet. And lastly is, you know, execution. The company, you know, has become more acquisitive in recent years, but its track record in acquisitions has been great. You know, this in comparison to the track record of M&A in corporate America, which is abominable, actually, when you look at the statistics. And most importantly, you know, management is being prudent in terms of capital allocation, you know, between acquisitions, not kind of set on autopilot, but only, you know, when the right opportunity exists. For instance, I alluded to their entrance into Canada and the UK. That was driven in large part because the customers were asking for solutions. Their existing customers were asking for solutions in those markets. And so, you know, in conclusion, you have a best-in-class VAR trading at a below-market multiple with a long runway for growth at attractive ROICs. We've held it for nearly 10 years, and we'd hope to hold it at least for another 10 more. So with that, I'll just leave you with my email in case you'd like to get in contact and talk about, you know, CDW or any other investing idea. And I'll turn it back over to you, John.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Alex, for the presentation. Perhaps a couple of questions from me, and then I'll encourage MOI Global members to follow up with any further thoughts or questions. On the capital allocation front, is there anything you might prioritize differently than the management is doing?
No, the answer is no. Like I said, you know, we've seen companies do all types of different moves on the capital allocation front. I think they've been extremely thoughtful in balancing share repurchases and M&A only when it makes sense. You know, we're big believers that, you know, great opportunities in investing, and this applies to companies as well, you know, don't come along every day. You're lucky if you get, you know, a handful every couple of years. And CDW has had the discipline to wait for those. So no, we like a lot what the management team has done in terms of capital allocation. And I think a lot of it has to do with they have their own egg nest in it as we do.
Terrific. In terms of data points to keep an eye on here to gauge how the thesis is playing out over time, what would be the key items to watch?
So for us, return on incremental invested capital is always something we're keeping an eye out. Obviously, being mindful of spending cycles for different businesses, it's a little different in the case of CDW because the capital spend is so light that doesn't really affect that, but it definitely bears watching in other businesses. But in this one in particular, you know, return on incremental invested capital, which for us includes M&A spend, and market share versus, you know, the broader IT industry in the United States. You know, you can get those numbers from different providers, Gartner, IDC, et cetera. there's a lot of public data on how much, you know, IT spending is growing. And then, you know, comparing that to CDW to continue to, you know, track that thesis of market share growth, which has been unfolding very nicely over the last couple of years. And we'd expect, you know, to continue into the future.
And in terms of the valuation, could you elaborate on how that compares to the historic range here, and you know, how you would rate this opportunity through time? Is this a particularly good time to get long here?
Well, listen, I think I alluded to the fact that we think it's pretty interesting value at this point. Is it the cheapest it's been in the last 10 years? No. When we first bought it, I'd have to go back and double check, but I think it was south of 14 times PE multiple when we originally bought it. Obviously, the broader markets have had a lot of multiple expansion since then. But, you know, it is what it is. And you compare it to the broader S&P today at 20 times earnings, CDW is trading at 18 times. It's a discount to the S&P. We believe it's a company that's of higher quality. And most importantly, we believe that, you know, the runway ahead for it is pretty long. So, I'd encourage you and other members to go back to that table that we put out to, you know, sensitize, you know, the multiple, if you believe and you do your work and get comfortable that the market share gain story will continue to play out. We think it becomes a very interesting multiple very quickly.
You described the moat here quite eloquently. I'm just wondering, you know, whether you could comment a little bit further on this kind of perennial view that these kinds of VARs are bound to get squeezed over time, that, you know, maybe in the very long term, there may not really be a need for these types of players. And that's been a charge for quite a while. It hasn't panned out, obviously. But yeah, just a little bit more color on that in the very long term.
Sure. Listen, we go back to the quote of, you know, the only constant in business is change. So any business will require management teams to adapt to changing environments and circumstances. In the case of CDW, you know, they started only with hardware, then they added software. More recently, they added services. We've done obviously a lot of work and thought a lot about the question that you ask. And, you know, we come out with, you know, IT is not necessarily simplifying, even though, you know, now we have AI and some of these things. IT is a pretty complex issue. And, you know, this whole notion of on-prem, hybrid, et cetera, the middleware, the integrations, I think in some capacity, it's actually making it somewhat more complex. So, you know, the work we've done makes us fairly comfortable that, you know, there's a place and a need for these companies. Remember who they're serving. You know, these are smaller enterprises and customers that don't really have, you know, deep IT departments, and they need help in understanding the solutions, pricing them, implementing them, monitoring them. And we don't think that that's going to go away. So, you know, a lot of the value comes from owning that customer relationship, having that trust, being on the approved vendor list. And from the perspective of their vendor partners, you know, you could ask why, you know, would Microsoft not just go directly? I mean, and the answer is, like I said, you know, the customer base is so fragmented and Microsoft doesn't really want to distract itself from its core business. They don't really want to be providing support and service for, you know, thousands and probably even hundreds of thousands or millions of customers. So we believe that, you know, the need for VARs is here to stay. That doesn't mean that the VAR business model will be exactly the same in 10 years as it is now, but that's probably true for every business.
Terrific. Well, I will leave it there, Alex. Thank you very much for joining us and sharing this investment thesis with the MOI Global community. And once again, I would encourage members to follow up. Thank you for showing your contact information here on the screen. It's been truly a pleasure.
Thank you very much, John.
Goodbye for now.
Bye.